This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
If you have a locked AT&T phone, we're here with Bolt Cutters. T-Mobile will help pay off your locked phone and give you a new 5G phone for free. All on America's largest 5G network. Visit T-Mobile.com/carrierfreedom.
Via virtual prepaid MasterCard in 15 days. Free phone up to $830 via 24 monthly bill credits plus tax and a $10 device connection charge. Qualifying port and trade-in service on Go5G Next and credit required. Contact us before canceling entire account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement as due. Bill credits end if you pay off devices early.
The details behind the Diddy indictment. Taylor Swift's stalkers. Jerry Lee trying to kill Elvis. Disgraceland dives into the dark side of entertainment every Tuesday. Follow and listen to Disgraceland on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
A sneeze that is halfway between happening and not, and that's because pollen is thick in the air. So what's the weather going to be like? Well, let me tell you here. It's going to be pretty nice all in all. Right now we're 67 degrees and it's humid. It feels like summertime to me outside right now. But today, it's going up to about 80 degrees, and then we warm throughout the week. Highs of 84 tomorrow, 86 Thursday, 86 Friday, Saturday likewise, and a chance for showers on Sunday. Highs of 75, and it cools off early next week. But this is going to be the last couple of cool fronts we get, so I would suggest we get out and enjoy them while we can. We start this morning talking about a new survey that's out, new poll that's out on President Trump, what most Americans approve of, what they don't. I invited you to text me at 504-260-1870. Tell me either what you like that he's doing, what you don't like that he's doing, or if you want to give me a grade on what he's doing. Somebody give me an E for a grade on Trump. I don't quite remember what that is. Aaron Dusso, Associate Professor of Political Science at Indiana University in Indianapolis. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
What does an E mean? Do you know?
I think we say E instead of F these days.
Oh, is it? Okay. Yeah. I didn't know. Somebody else said a D. I would like them to expand on what do you think he's doing wrong or what do you think he's doing right? What do the latest polls show?
Right. It seems like the people are most happy with his immigration, at least a 50-50 breakdown in the country on immigration. So he's handling that fairly well, according to the country. He's doing the worst on the economy, which is a particularly dangerous thing for him because the economy is obviously the single biggest issue. It's probably the reason why he ended up winning the election. And there's a big change from his first term. So just to put it in context, in 2017, at this period in his administration, he would have been plus 4 to 8 points on the economy, and now he's negative. According to this most recent poll, he's -8. So you're talking about maybe a 16-point swing from his first term to now, and that's a big problem that he's going to want to try and address soon because it ate up Biden's administration.
One thing I wonder about is, I got some neighbors that are ardent Trump fans and have displays and so forth, live in a very conservative neighborhood, and that's fine. It's America; they can talk about what they want. But some of these plans that he has, some of them could wind up hurting them. And I just wonder how, when it comes to Trump's ardent 38% or whatever he's had, do they blame him for the economy? Do they hold him responsible for the economy? Or do they instead attribute it to something else and remain loyal to President Trump no matter what?
I mean, yeah, we're talking about that ardent 38 to 40%. I would say they are not going to see right now what the rest of the country is seeing. And so they're going to stick with him. They're going to interpret numbers and things that are happening with Social Security or with the economy going down and tariffs and prices going up. They're going to not blame Donald Trump. They're going to find a way to convince themselves that it's not Donald Trump. I mean, a big danger, though, is if you see that crack, that base cracks for Donald Trump, then there's really big problems. If he starts dropping below 38%, that he knows that he's losing his core people, and that's when you know you're in big trouble.
And that's what I think is going to be interesting to see about this because, and look, Somebody texted in, E is for excellent. So there you go.
Okay.
Somebody else said D for dummy, Trump, super, A, and 20, go, 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 Trump, Elon, need him for third term. We'll talk about that if you like in a minute. Reckless layoffs, deporting legal status citizens in the wrong countries, horrible for the economy. Let's talk about the that 38%, though. When it comes to holding Trump responsible for the economy, as most presidents are, and just like the quarterback in a football game get maybe more blame than they should or more than they shouldn't, when it comes to tariffs, has that equation changed with President Trump?
I mean, that's the thing with this is the key kind of centerpiece to his administration is this tariffs when it comes to the economy. And that is so closely tied to him that he's almost set it up as you're going to judge me based on the success or failure of these tariffs that are clearly him doing it. Because I agree, we almost always give too much praise or too much criticism of a president for the economy because they don't really have that much control. But when it comes to these tariffs, he's imposing them unilaterally himself. That is him, and I think people are making that connection.
When I saw these results, I got to thinking about Ronald Reagan and how they used to call him the Teflon president. Is Donald Trump, to some extent, a Teflon president like Reagan, or is it only about that 38% to 40%?
I mean, so Reagan had higher approval ratings. Certainly at this point in time, he's up in, you know, closer to 60% approval ratings. So what Donald Trump seems to that base, you know, the mega follower of Trump does appear to be Teflon. I mean, you just cannot have an effect on him no matter what happens. So we just saw Singlegate last week, and that could have, you know, again, ate up an entire presidency very easily, but it does not seem to have been going to hurt Donald Trump in any real significant way.
That's what led to the, somebody said, y'all are delusional here, a text line, and a Trump hater, Biden created this mess. Biden had nothing to do with tariffs, so you could, again, people can believe whatever they want. And that's fine, because this is America, right, Professor? This is America, and it's not just about politics. Apparently, you can create whatever truth you want and believe it. That's what America has become. So create your own truth and believe it. I'm not going to fight you on it. That's your choice if that's what you choose to do. But when it comes to signal gate, if you will, that's what I meant specifically when I talked about being a Teflon president. But is that just about his 38 to 40%, or does his Teflon coating extend to beyond that 40%?
Well, I think more people have actually, you know, than just his base have been able to overlook that, because his approval rating overall is actually fairly strong for Donald Trump. I mean, he's only about 4 points, 3 or 4 points, depending on where you look, underwater. And that's better than he was in 2017. So compared to 2017, at this time, he was 8 points underwater. So you have Signalgate, and it does not seem to have moved his overall approval rating. So he's certainly gained more than just his base right now. Can he hold on to him is the real question.
So that's my question, I guess, is if the people don't like the economy or what's going on with the economy or tariffs and they're concerned about that and they're not part of that 38 to 40%, we can pick it up here when we come back. How does Signalgate have nothing to do, or I guess the name of it you would call it that, the defense snafu, if you want to call it that, with Pete Hegseth? And again, some people say it wasn't classified information. Again, you can believe whatever you want. But that would have caused a lot of presidents a lot of problems, and I just wonder what it is that Trump's doing that shielded him from any responsibility when it comes to that. Even at one point, they talked about 4 missing soldiers, and he said he hadn't been briefed on that. And if that had happened with Biden, and look, I'm not taking up for Biden at all. I'm just saying that in terms of the Trump faithful, they would have been all over that and talked about the senility, this, that, the other thing, or the ineffectiveness of the White House, that the president hadn't been briefed on 4 missing soldiers. But here he gets a pass, and I just wonder why people look at it that way. 621, not criticizing them for doing it, just asking. Traffic now, WWL. 625, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to our friend, Professor Aaron Dusso, Associate Professor of Political Science at Indiana University, Indianapolis, about a new poll out about President Trump and what Americans want to see more of and less of. Somebody texted in, let's see how Trump does in 4 years, not just 4 months. It's interesting. Somebody else said, think long term. Somebody else said, ain't America a great place? MAGA, God, Trump, family, and guns. Okay. And then somebody else said, I would have never voted for Trump if I'd known what he was going to be doing with the economy. Well, let's talk about the economy, Professor, because a lot of things comprise the economy. What do these poll numbers say, or what specifically do Americans think of the economy and President Trump's responsibility for it? I do know that I asked a kind of conservative financial expert before President Trump was inaugurated because I just wanted to get a baseline on this, not trying to prove a point or anything, just for reference sakes. Where would you say the economy is right now, scale of 1 to 10, that President Trump's inheriting? And he told me an 8. And I wanted to, again, have that as a baseline. So I don't know how Americans view the economy now or not. It's only been 4 months. What do these poll numbers indicate or show about the economy and President Trump's handling of it, prices, inflation? Again, stock markets, so many things comprise the economy, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, it's obviously a huge issue. And I would agree with the people that texted in saying that you can't judge based on 4 months. I mean, so you do need a longer time horizon to see what works and what doesn't. But ultimately, I mean, you know, people, you know, consumer confidence is another, you know, survey measure of how things are going. And that's obviously has gone down significantly over the last few months. And that's generally seen as a strong indicator of where things are going with regards to economy, at least in general. Now, the economy is just, politically, it's just such a dangerous issue because it can overwhelm you as a president. You can have all the messaging you want. You can have your strong base. But no president, even Donald Trump, has a strong enough base in order to essentially win elections or maintain, you know, strong enough power to be able to push things through Congress that he needs to be able to do. So, you know, the economy is the thing. And, you know, he's going to, you know, tomorrow we're going to find out about tariffs even more. And if he's going to push forward on that, he's going to have to hope that tariffs really do work and they work relatively quickly because he could fall into a hole that's so deep that he can never really recover from.
And the other thing I wonder is, as it relates to the economy and the power that President Trump yields and the fear that he instills in Republican members of Congress, at what point does the economy either have them peeling off from him, or are they so terrified of him and being primaried or whatever, getting in his ill graces that they stick with him no matter what? You understand what I'm saying? It seems like at right. some point there's going to be a tipping point politically if the economy goes sour, and I'm not saying it is. I'm just saying if that does happen, then what happens politically with the Republicans in Congress and their loyalty, fealty to President Trump?
Yeah. So the economy is the one issue to me that is strong enough, big enough that it's so widespread that can't be ignored. There's no political spin that can ignore when people are paying, you know, 20% more or they lose their job. You can't spin that. And so that makes it such a powerful issue that it can actually break that base of Donald Trump. And I think that that's the thing that would cause members of Congress in the House or the Senate to say, you know, now I'm seeing my own constituents. I'm seeing people who have been, you know, ardent followers of Donald Trump. They're starting to be concerned. They're starting to turn away. And that's going to be the break that will cause Donald Trump to lose support within Congress. And people and members of his own party will start kind of distancing themselves. Why? Because they're not afraid of him being able to primary them anymore. They're not afraid of him being able to turn their own constituents against him because his own constituents are already starting to tune him out.
So the only way that Donald Trump loses his power over congressional Republicans is if it starts at home, and if the people, for whatever reason, if the economy goes south and people react badly to that?
That would be my argument, yes.
Mm-hmm. I got you. Okay, I understand. Thank you, Professor. I appreciate your time. Professor Aaron Dusso, who is the Associate Professor of Political Science at Indiana University, Indianapolis. Leave President Trump out of it. Let's just talk about the economy. What do you think? How is the economy? What grade would you give the economy? And are you having economic troubles or not? Do you blame anybody for that? Do you think the economy's better or worse since President Trump came in? As for me, I don't really notice any change from my personal standpoint. I did make some moves ahead of tariffs with the stock market and all of that because I anticipated some trouble. But other than that, I think everything's fine for me, but let me know how it's working out for you at 504-260-1870. Right now, we pause for WWL First News. 644, 16 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Somebody texted in and said, why do you always talk about President Trump and you didn't talk about Biden? Well, because Biden didn't do anything. Remember, you didn't know where Joe Biden was. You didn't know if he was awake. You didn't know if he knew what day it was. You didn't know what room he was walking into. I don't know if he knew what room he was walking into. Remember the infamous debate in June, I think it was, of 2024, where Donald Trump said candidly, I don't know what he's saying, and I don't know if he knows what he's saying. Biden never did anything. President Trump does stuff every day with executive orders. I get them emailed to me constantly, and that's why we're going to talk about that later on, about the executive orders that he's issuing and some of the nomenclature, the wording of executive orders is in bring common sense and subjective terms like that. And when it comes to executive orders and things of law, I don't think you can have words like common sense or everybody knows or it only you one would believe. And it just that's not the way law works. Anyway, let's move on. Talk with Jan Moeller now, our guest, executive director of Invest in Louisiana, to talk about some cuts to Medicaid and SNAP or proposed cuts. How you doing, Jan?
Great, Tommy. Thanks for having me on, as always.
Thanks for taking the time. Are we talking about cuts or proposed cuts?
Well, right now they are proposed cuts. And as things stand, you know, Congress is just getting working on the budget. But right now there's a budget resolution that has passed the House of Representatives that would cut almost $1 trillion from the Medicaid program and would also cut money from food assistance. I think about $200 billion from food assistance.
They're
being threatened.
Yeah, let me go slow here, Jan, if I can. So take me through the process, if you will. So it's passed the House committee or the entire House?
It's a House budget resolution. Okay. And that is a resolution that basically just sets broad parameters for what can go in the budget, but the actual budget bill hasn't passed at all, and that's where the rubber meets the road. So right now they basically all that's happened is Congress has signaled its intent to pass a budget, and they give each committee kind of spending goals, but in all practical terms, the House of Representatives is on record as wanting to cut about $880 billion from the Medicaid program over 10 years.
Now, I'm not trying to get you to do Schoolhouse of Rock or teach civics, but I think the process is important. And again, as I always say, Jan, I don't want to get too far in the weeds, but having played golf for money, I can tell you that's where most of the cheating goes on, is in the weeds, right? So when
Absolutely.
You say a House budget resolution, the committees get together, and then somehow these people, men and women, meet and say, this is what we want the budget to look like, so this is the resolution that we're going to pass. And from this point, what happens?
Well, then they have to pass the actual budget. And what President Trump is talking about doing is passing, you know, you've heard him talk about one big, beautiful bill. Mm-hmm. And this is going to get in the weeds, Tommy, but there's
again,
a process.
That's where most of the cheating goes in. Go ahead.
There's a process called budget reconciliation that can only be used in certain circumstances. And why reconciliation is important is because it can bypass if the bill does certain things, it can bypass the Senate filibuster. As you know, Tommy, the filibuster rule in the Senate means that most bills need 60 out of 100 votes to pass, not 50 or 51 votes. And so the president is and the congressional leaders hope to use reconciliation to pass a budget that cuts or extends and builds on the tax cuts that passed in the first Trump administration, and then also makes a whole bunch of cuts. And so that bill is expected to pass sometime later this year, because there's no practical way that the president can get 60 votes for his agenda, because there just aren't enough Democrats who, of course, are going to vote for this.
The only reason I wanted to go into all of that was the likelihood of this happening before we talk about the effects of it. So if, for example, $880 billion is cut from Medicaid spending, what would that look like in Louisiana?
Well, frankly, it would be devastating in Louisiana, and it would be devastating for patients who depend on the Medicaid program. About one in three Louisianans get their health coverage from the Medicaid program. Medicaid serves people with low incomes or disabilities and elderly people in nursing homes. So if the federal government cuts that money, then the state is going to have to cut either eligibility or payments. It means people, frankly, are going to lose their health care, but it also means that hospitals, doctors, clinics, pharmacies, all of the private health care providers that participate in the program, that deliver the care and that receive this money, are going to be hurting. And so I think you're going to see not just ripple effects in health, but you're also going to see serious impacts on the state economy, which, you know, this is almost a $20 billion program in Louisiana. And if that money goes away, then local economies. And I mean, Medicaid has a fiscal impact in every corner of Louisiana.
So what you're saying, and we can pick it up here after the break, is it's $20 billion of business being conducted. It's health-related business, but it's $20 billion of business being conducted that's going to go away. Accurate?
Absolutely. And we think of this as a government program, but people need to understand that this is money that goes to private health care providers, by and large.
And people that code the insurance forms and people that work in the doctor's offices, et cetera, accurate?
Absolutely.
Okay, we'll pick it up. We come back 6:51, 9 till 7. Traffic now, WWL. 6:56, Tommy Tucker, 4 till 7. Talking to Jan Moeller, Executive Director of the Invest in Louisiana, talking about what Medicaid cuts and SNAP cuts could look like. So let's talk about the cuts to, you talked about Medicaid, and what was the other one, $880 billion to Medicaid? What about $200 billion
to SNAP.
SNAP, yeah. Talk about that, if you will, please.
Sure. Well, SNAP is the program that I think most people know as food stamps. It stands for Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, and it's the other big federal benefit program that goes to, you know, people in every state, and it helps mostly working families afford to put food on the table. And kind of just like Medicaid, it's one of those programs. Obviously, the people who receive it, they get food that allows them and their families to eat. But it also plays a huge role in the bottom line of grocery stores, farmers markets. It supports farmers that make the food, that grow the food. So this is a program that we think about it as a benefit program for people who need a little help making ends meet. But it also plays a major role in the economy, in every region of the state, every region of the country. So if you cut SNAP, nobody's talking about eliminating the program, you're also cutting into the bottom lines of a lot of people who make and sell food to the public.
When it comes to, I think people. So, you know, look, everybody's got an anecdotal story about somebody that went and you know, maybe it's anecdotal, maybe it's just an urban legend. I don't know. Or they heard it and they repeat it. They know a guy who knew a guy that got ribeye steaks and put them back, or got dog food and food stamps, wouldn't pay for it, so they bought ribeye steaks. Well, I'll use my food stamps for this. Or they got ribeye steaks and then got into a brand new Cadillac and drove off. Those are the tropes that you hear about food stamps. Let's just take for people that believe that is the norm, and it's not, but let's just imagine, for example, that this goes away, this aid for SNAP. What's going to happen in Louisiana? What would it look like to people, to families, et cetera? And then what would be the effect of that?
Well, we know Louisiana struggles with hunger more than just about any other state. You know, the USDA calls it food insecurity. So we know that if you want to catch if you're trying to catch a few bad apples, let's assume that they exist. I think you're right. It's mostly an urban trope. You're also going to trap a lot of families, single moms, people who work but don't make a lot of money. You're going to make it harder for people to put food on the table. But again, you're also going to hurt a whole lot of small businesses, medium-sized business. We're talking Albertsons and Walmarts, but also that corner grocery store that depend on these dollars. And if anybody thinks it's easy to cheat the government and get these benefits, go on the state's website and look at the hoops that you have to jump through to qualify for SNAP. There are already hurdles in front of people who want to get on this program. They monitor this carefully, and so this is not a program that is riddled with fraud, but it is a program that helps people put food on the table so that they and their kids can eat.
Thank you, Jan. Appreciate your time and the insight. Jan Mueller, Executive Director of Invest in Louisiana. We'll be back. 7:14 now on this April 1st, April Fool's Day. Be aware of that. Aaron Holmes joins us now, Executive Director of the View Cray Property Owners, Residents, and Associates. Good morning, Aaron. How are you?
Doing well, Tommy. How are you doing?
I'm good. Have you ever pulled any April Fool's pranks or been the victim of any?
I think I'm often the victim of them before I pull them.
One time I thought it would be funny to tell my mom years and years and years ago that my then wife was pregnant, and she started crying. She was so happy and excited, and I realized at that point that I'd made a tremendous mistake, that it was not funny. It was a stupid thing to do on April 1st, and that was probably my the worst thing that I've ever done on April 1st.
That's pretty terrible.
Well, you know what? I realize that now. Aaron, at the time, I realize that now, but at the time, I didn't. Let's talk about thanks for telling me that, though. Thanks for telling me that. It's pretty terrible because I haven't beat myself up enough over these years for it. Thanks, Aaron, for piling on. I'm just kidding.
Sorry, Tommy.
No, I'm just kidding. Tell me first about the meeting that happened last week about the Bourbon Street security and so forth. And was any new information gleaned from that?
Well, actually, no, but we didn't really expect any new information. So we hosted it. We actually partnered up with NOPD to host a town hall style meeting about the Bourbon Street security plan. And really what we wanted to do was get stakeholders in the room that had not gotten to talk to NOPD about some of these preliminary plans. So we didn't anticipate learning anything new. We just thought that we were going to get a little bit more information for the crowd, so to speak.
What was the meeting like, and what did you hear, and what did people have to say?
Well, it was very well attended. We thought maybe we'd get about 100 people, but it was standing room only. I think there were at least 250 people there, and it was a really good mix of residents and business owners and workers and a lot of street performers as well. So Everybody was kind of operating on concern for what they had heard. So we were really hoping that we were going to get some actionable items, but we're still waiting for the final recommendation from the consulting firm Teneo, and that information has not been made public.
I was going to ask you about that, because at first I think Freddie King had released a statement saying that it was going to be there. Then they said they weren't going to present it. Do you know when that's supposed to come out?
I don't know. I know that it has been completed, and it has been given over to the Police and Justice Foundation, which commissioned it. But from there, and in terms of who gets to see it, who gets to analyze it, how it's going to be released to the public, I don't know.
So when it comes to what the people at the meeting had to say, A, do you think it was representative of the quarter as a whole? And secondly, what were some of the things that they wanted to see or didn't want to see?
I would definitely say it was pretty representative of the diverse stakeholders that are in the French Quarter. You know, residents were very concerned that any permanent solutions, so to speak, would, you know, increase traffic or congest the traffic grid. We would lose parking, necessary parking, access to our homes, or there'd be, you know, a concentration of larger vehicles more in the residential end, things that would have come out of, you know, maybe a 24/7 pedestrian mall or closure for Bourbon Street. Mm-hmm. And also a rumor had started, and I'm not sure the level of truth to it, that if Bourbon Street were converted into a full pedestrian mall, then they would close the Royal Street pedestrian mall, which really fired up a lot of the street performers and musicians because they use that area as a frequent busking location. And so I think it was an opportunity for the public that has not been engaged yet to get into the room to ask questions and voice concerns.
Tell me about the Royal Street pedestrian mall.
The Royal Street Pedestrian Mall is frequently used as street performers. So from 11 to 4 p.m. daily, it is closed to vehicular traffic. And so you'll see a lot of street performers, specifically over the corner at Rouse's. Street performers are often grouped around there, and they get larger crowds. And the pedestrian mall has been in effect for decades, really, but it was definitely during the time of COVID and also following the Hard Rock collapse. It was the hours of it were changed, and it was open most of the time, but most recently it has been closed.
And we're talking about between where and where, Aaron?
Oh, let's see. Royal Street Pedestrian Mall runs from Orleans Avenue basically through the canal. So, but your pedestrian mall activity is probably going to happen mostly between Royal and, say, Conti.
I got you. I was not aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there you go. Maybe I should go more often. what about the split between businesses and residents? Was there a disagreement as between those two groups, or did they see things the same?
Well, I mean, I think there was a level of disagreement between stakeholders only because different stakeholders have different needs. But I would say that what I heard were mostly that we do need to increase safety, and we need to ensure safety for, you know, everybody in the French Quarter, visitors and locals alike. But we also can't compromise what it means to be an actual neighborhood. So the businesses were saying, how do I get my deliveries? How do I get my employees to my businesses? The residents were saying, how do I maintain access to my home? And the industry workers and street performers are saying, how do I get to where I need to go to work? Mm-hmm. So basically it was, yes, we need to increase safety, and we need to find the best implementation of that, but still the French Quarter has to function.
And you're saying the Royal Street Pedestrian Mall, just so I got you right, runs from where to where?
I was saying it starts at Orleans Avenue and it heads upriver. I don't know where the final barricade is, but it's heading towards Canal. But usually about 5 blocks of Royal Street from 11 to 4 p.m. daily, maybe even longer hours on the weekends, are closed to vehicular traffic.
I had no idea. You taught me something. All right, we'll take a break, pick it up when we come back. Talking to Aaron Holmes, our friend, executive director of the Vieux-Carré Property Owners, Residents, and Associates, talking about some of the proposals that have been made. We'll also talk about the Teneo proposal when that's expected. 721 traffic now, WWL. 726, Tommy Tucker, WWL, on this Tuesday morning, April 1st, back with Aaron Holmes, executive director of the Vieux-Carré Property Owners, Residents, and Associates. Aaron, I'm just going back to my April Fool's joke that I pulled and you said, and I quote, "Wow, that's terrible." That
maybe that was a little harsh.
No. I don't think it was harsh at all. I think I deserved it, and it just brought back all the memories of making my mom cry and being stupid. Somebody texted and said that Royal Street is closed between Conti and Orleans. That is, as it stands now, a pedestrian mall between when and when?
I want to say 11 to 4 p.m., but
and the concern,
you know, there's always room for error.
And the concern was that if Bourbon Street should become a pedestrian mall, that they would have to open Royal Street because otherwise that would be too much pedestrian mall?
I think so. But again, I said that was an unverified rumor, but it definitely mobilized individuals that, you know, perform on that strip or businesses on that strip to come out and make their voices heard.
So do we know when the report from Teneo is going to be released, and then what happens from that point?
No, we don't know when it's going to be released. That's really a timetable that's up to the administration and NOPD. But I think the big question is what then? You know, so we're going to get a set of recommendations that the city leaders can choose some or all of. But then there's going to be a process of how to implement. So I spoke about the two pedestrian malls, Bourbon Street and Royal. Those were created through a city council ordinance. And so if they're going to be amended, it has to go through the city council. And we've heard from the administration that that she can implement things through her various administrative departments. But then there's also NOPD. But I think that nothing's going to change overnight, because if you look at other cities that have done major pedestrianization projects, it takes a lot of resources, it takes a lot of logistics for implementation, it takes money, and it takes time. So what I think we have right now, which are temporary barricades that are on loan to NOPD, you know, we're going to look to see how do we harden or make those barricades a little bit more permanent. But nothing's going to happen overnight. It's just too much resource management. So I think it's very clear that we are not going to get the level of personnel security that we've had for the past couple of months. So we are going to need to implement something that doesn't require that manpower. But how it's going to work and how long it's going to take remain up in the air.
Give me a snapshot of today and a quarter as opposed to January 2nd and a quarter.
Well, we're gearing up for festival season. So January 2nd and the quarter was, it was a pretty terrible time to be in the quarter. It was a lot of trying to wrap our heads around what had happened and what the aftermath could be. We, even on the 2nd, we didn't know if there were additional planted explosive devices. So that was a terrifying time. Fast forward to today, I think that residents and businesses are trying to get back in action. You know, we've been through an epic snowstorm, a Super Bowl. We've been through Mardi Gras. We're looking for a little normal day to day, but going into festival season, hoping that we are going to get the level of business, especially to our small businesses in the French Quarter. And of course, we're getting some nice weather now. So it's pretty nice in the French Quarter right now, but you can definitely still see the evidence of the terrorist attack from the 1st.
I appreciate your time. I really do, Jamie, and I hope you, and I hope you come back and talk to us after the report comes out, and we'll see where we stand.
I'd be happy to.
Thank you. Aaron Holmes, Executive Director of the Vieux-Carré Property Owners, Residents, and Associates. Speaking of Jamie, we'll talk to Jamie Rowan when we come back about President Trump's executive orders. Right now, time for WWL First News. 743, 17 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, on this April Fool's Day. Talking to our friend Jamie Rowan, Associate Professor of Legal Studies at UMass Amherst, Director of the Center for Justice, Law, and Societies. Good morning, Jamie. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. Well, thank you.
Would you please clear it up for me? Is it Rowan or Rowan? I want to make sure I get it right.
Rowan.
Okay, like Rowan and Martin, but you're too young to remember that, but I will. Let's talk about, first of all, because I know people are going to get all fed up and riled up and worked up, so let's talk about the history of executive orders and presidents through the years and timelines and all that kind of stuff to give us some context, okay?
Sure. So we talked about executive orders because there's various ways in which the government engages in lawmaking. One way is when the executive branch says there is something that needs to be done, and it's usually related to its own branch's power, which is supposed to be national security. And so if you're in war, you issue an executive order because there isn't time to go through the legislative branch. So the president that made the most executive orders was Franklin Roosevelt during World War II. Aside from him, most executive orders have come at the end of an attempt to use the legislative branch to make law, and where the executive says it's not happening and we need to do something that's within my executive authority, like with immigration. That's an example of where the executive branch may say, I have authority over immigration. I want to do something about that. In the case of Joe Biden, for example, he used the executive authority to bypass legislative gridlock over student debt relief. The thing about executive authority and using an executive order is that it has to be in line with the Constitution. And if it's not, then there has to be an opportunity to challenge the executive order in court.
Let me jump in, if I can, Jamie, for a second, and ask, what does the Constitution say about executive orders? Does it address it?
No. But the Constitution is a very bare-bones instrument. It basically says there are three branches of government, and each branch of government has a designated role to play. The executive is supposed to faithfully execute laws that are passed by the legislative branch. And the legislative branch is supposed to pass most of the laws because it is the most representative body. So when our founders were interested in democracy and making sure everybody in the country that at the time could vote had a voice in government, it vested most powers in the legislative branch in Congress. The executive branch is supposed to just execute those laws.
So how did the executive order come to be? Did one president say, you know what? Here's the deal. You're not going to get it done. I'm going to issue an executive order, and then let's see what happens. I'm serious about that. I'm curious.
Yeah, so I think what happened was at a certain point, all you look at the Constitution, and the branches of government say, what is within my authority? And so a president said, I am going to promulgate a law. I am going to make a law and just issued it. And that was okay. And so that's been happening again. Like I said, it started during war times. It started, this type of lawmaking is not new. Mm-hmm. And again, though, it's not new. It's not particularly novel. But it was always within, or it has mostly been within, the scope of what the executive branch is supposed to make executive orders on, which I said is national security, because that is the main area of executive authority in the country.
At what point did there begin to be executive order creep, where it led from in times of war or in for national security?
So I would say that practice of using executive orders has really exploded in the past 30 years. And I think when you look at President Clinton, when he came to power, he was coming to power after a 30-year spell of all of the branches of government being within the Democratic Party. And then during the midterms for President Clinton in 94, Newt Gingrich and the Contract on America took over, and there you now had a split branch. You had an executive that was Democratic, and you had a legislative branch that was Republican. And that Republican legislative branch didn't want to pass laws that were aligned with President Clinton's interests. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, you start to see, okay, what is the opportunity for an executive to pass laws that the legislative branch of government isn't supportive of?
So real quick, and one more question about context before we move on to current day. When it comes to Congress, is it about Congress politically not wanting to pass a law and forcing the president to veto it if he doesn't like it, concerned with not having enough votes to override a veto? Or is it about there are some situations that are so divisive that they don't want to affect or anger the folks back home, so they just abdicate the authority and say, you know what, we're going to do anything. And with that vacuum existing, the sitting president, whomever it happens to be, says, okay, I'll take care of it. Thoughts?
So one thing that we didn't mention that's really important is that executive orders have grown with the growth of the administrative state. And that, again, is something that came about during the 40s, where it appeared that there were issues that were concerning Americans, that the setup of the Constitution was not allowing for good implementation. So if the federal government is interested in addressing the economy, where in the Constitution does it allow it to do that? And so the federal government started creating agencies. The thing about these agencies is that Congress creates them, but the executive branch administers them. And this is where it gets confusing. The executive branch, the executive then makes executive orders that are targeted at those administrative agencies. And so when an administrative agency is not making rules effectively, the executive might just say, here's the rule that we want to pass. And when what happens is that Congress is basically not passing a lot of laws. And that has been going on for decades now. Congress is a bit gridlocked. And so because the executive agencies are working from older laws passed by Congress, the executive branch is stepping in and saying, well, look, Congress isn't changing the rules. I'm going to go ahead and change the rules.
Now, when you say effective laws, that's a subjective term, right? Let's pick it up there when we come back, and we'll talk about what's going on with President Trump and with former President Biden, all that stuff, with Jamie Rowan when we come back. Our friend, Associate Professor of Legal Studies at UMass Amherst, Director of the Center for Justice, Law, and Societies. I've been talking about executive orders for about 15 years, and that's the best explanation I have ever heard of it. Thank you, Jamie. 7:51 now, traffic, WWL. Sam 55, 5 till 8, Tommy Tucker talking to Jamie Rowan on WWL, Associate Professor of Legal Studies, UMass Amherst, and Director of the Center for Justice, Law, and Societies. We've already given you the background on history and executive orders. Jamie, what is different about the executive orders that President Trump is issuing?
These are really different than what has happened in the past. And so, again, there's not an increase. There is an increase in number. Trump has issued the most executive orders in his first days of office than other presidents. But the content of these executive orders is really different. So typically when an executive order is made, it states where in the Constitution or in legislation the president gets the authority to make the order. It roots it in existing law. And so presidents before Trump were very careful to make sure that their executive orders would withstand a judicial challenge. Any law, whether by the legislative branch or the executive branch, is subject to judicial review. The court can look at it and say, this law goes against the Constitution. Mm-hmm. What Trump is doing is he is not saying where the power of his executive authority comes from. He's not saying that he actually even has the constitutional authority to make these rules. Moreover, several of these executive orders are directly in contrast to what the Constitution allows. The most blatant of these are the executive orders that are targeting law firms, for example. These executive orders go against the First Amendment, which protects for speech and association, and they also go against the Fifth Amendment and the Sixth Amendment, which provide due process, because it's basically saying individuals that want to have lawyers represent them cannot have those lawyers represent them. And it's against the First Amendment because it is saying that lawyers that have represented clients that have causes the president doesn't like are going to be financially harmed to the point that they might not be able to work anymore. And so that is really different. And that is why conservative lawyers are saying this has so outside the bounds of the Constitution that they're challenging those executive orders in court. The thing that's complicated and what the listeners should recognize is that even if you can challenge an executive order in court, the fact that the executive order was made is very damaging. It's like a prosecutor who is threatening lawsuits against people who he knows is innocent. Those innocent people may be able to defend themselves in court, but the cost of defending themselves in court is very high. And so just the act is doing damage.
So it's kind of like suing somebody, and I'm just going to make a, boy, this could be maybe a terrible analogy, Jamie, but once the president, any president, issues an executive order, then it's like, all right, this is the law unless you have the means or the wherewithal to challenge me in court to prove that it isn't?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
But in addition to that, even if you do have the means, as these law firms do, it still is doing damage in the interim because you're scaring off potential clients, right? And the interesting thing about the law firms, and this is why I think it's important to pay attention to them, is that these law firms are not partisan. These law firms are representing people from across the political spectrum. They don't have political identities. And that's really what's scary.
It's the interim that is the problem. Jamie, you have to come back and talk more about this. Jamie Rowan, Associate Professor of Legal Studies at UMass Amherst and Director of the Center for Justice, Law, and Societies. I think a lot of this could be cleared up if Congress were to do its job, but everybody there is a little bit more concerned about getting reelected than they are with the country. At least that's my opinion. We'll talk about the election over the weekend. We come back with Pearson Cross, a political scientist at ULM. 8:15 now, as you all know, the amendments, all four amendments that were put up for the voters on Saturday's election were defeated resoundingly, and we wanted to get another political scientist's thoughts on what happened and why and what happens from here. Pearson Cross joins us, our friend, professor of political science at ULM. How you doing, doctor, professor?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Pearson? Yeah, let's go with Pearson.
Any of the above.
How about
works
PC?
Just fine.
How about PC? Call you PC.
Yeah, I like that.
All right, PC.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's talk about the amendments themselves. First of all, as a political scientist, did it have to do, what did you infer from the results? I'll start there.
Yeah, some people have been inferring that it's a big defeat for Jeff Landry, and it is a setback. But really, I think the amendments lost on their own without Jeff Landry's help. You know, I mean, I think voters were making a statement about too much too soon and overreaching. And I think Amendment 2 kind of sums all that up.
Pearson, I apologize to you. I clumsily disconnected my headphones and I didn't hear a word of what you said. I'm just being honest. Can you tell me again, please?
Sure. Yeah, I didn't see it as a referendum on Governor Jeff Landry. I saw it instead as a, you know, a true expression of voter sentiment, which was that, particularly in Amendment 2, it was too much too soon. It was too hard to digest. There were groups, you know, from the far left and the far right against this. It's unusual when you get a coalition like that opposing something. And the governor perhaps could have done a slightly better job of publicizing it, but really the fault was in the creation.
Let me ask you about that a little bit, because it seems to me, and the way, you know, I talked to God knows how many people about this before, and when it comes to Amendment number 2 specifically, I characterized it as there is so much in here. There are so many consequences, both intended and unintended. Basically, this comes down to, and everybody that was in for it said, yes, it comes down to, trust me, this is the best thing for the state. Would that be accurate or not?
Yeah, I think that's really accurate, because there were so many moving parts. I mean, the bill was 115 pages long, and then to ask voters just to read a small paragraph, because we know voters aren't going to read the bill, so read just a small paragraph, really just like 1.5 sentences, and then make a decision about something that momentous, it was just too much to ask people to do.
So does that, if that's the case, then if it was about trust me, can we infer from that that the voting public was saying, nah, I don't completely trust y'all? Not necessarily the governor, the legislature, the entire Louisiana government when it comes to revising so many things in the state constitution.
Well, we know that trust in government is at a historic low. But, you know, this is not unusual. There have been 325 amendments proposed since 1974. You know, 221 of those have passed, so over 100 have been shot down. So it's not particularly unusual. There were some Trump effects on this one. I think there was an unusually high outpouring of people who said, this is my first chance to say no to something since Donald Trump got elected. And I think so you saw some of that as well, I believe.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you about that, because Louisiana overwhelmingly went for Trump in the presidential election, correct?
That's correct.
So when it comes to turnout, do we know yet if it was people that either didn't vote in the presidential election, didn't vote for, well, we wouldn't know who voted for Trump or not, Trump voters? What I'm trying to say is, did this motivate the anti-Trump base to come out, or does it reflect in any way perhaps dissatisfaction with Trump voters with what they've seen so far, or neither? I don't know. Tell me.
Yeah, well, I would say, first of all, turnout was around 21%, although it varies by parish. You know, in some places, you know, there are chronic voters who came out in this election. Those are people who vote every time, and those would be across the spectrum, you know, Republican and Democrat. Now, the Amendment 2 went down to a crushing defeat in Orleans Parish, 73,000 to 7,000. So it had 91% no's. So I think you would expect to see, well, that's kind of a partisan outcome there in a place we would expect it. Mm-hmm. What we wouldn't expect is that in Ouachita Parish, where I live, you know, there was about a 60-40 split on no's as well, you know, which is an area that's very strong Trump country. So I think this really says more about the amendment than it says about larger effects.
Did the let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Pearson Cross, professor of political science at ULM. By the way, Pearson, my kid lives in Ruston, which is very close to Monroe, as you well know.
Of course.
That's a beautiful area of the country. It really is, of the state. Both Monroe and West Monroe, if y'all have not been, and even Ruston, you need to go and take a trip, because it's a beautiful area to just visit. 820 traffic now, WWL. 825, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to our friend Pearson Cross, professor of political science at ULM. We already talked about Amendment number 2. Did all of the amendments, Pearson, go down by the same amount in the same areas, or was there was it different? That's what I was trying to say. Was it different?
Yeah, no, they did. So it's really amazing. So Amendment 1 went down 65-35. Amendment 2, 65-35. Amendment 3, 66-34. Amendment 4, 64-36. I mean, they're all right in the same ballpark. So voters didn't like all of them.
Is it all, like eating potato chips when it comes to voting no to amendments? And I'm not trying to be silly when I say that. Is it I don't like this, and I'm just going to vote. I think this is a bad amendment. I don't like it, so I'm just going to, while I'm going, I'm going to vote against them all.
That could be it. You know, voters in the past have shown, like, for example, in 1970 or 1974, voters went to the ballot and were asked to choose to vote on 50 constitutional amendments, and they voted them all down. And I think that was just a general revulsion of the public of just like, why are you making us do this? And so I think there was some of that. I think people are tired of these amendments, election after election.
Are voters, other than chronic voters, savvy enough to sense like when an amendment is put on an obscure election date like March 29th, to think that maybe there's some chicanery going on?
Yeah, that could be part of it. To understand that, they would have to get out and vote, and the only people who do that really are the chronic voters. So, you know, the chronic voters basically said no, and with perhaps a smattering of people who were, you know, upset about other issues. But what was interesting on this was that you had people like Tony Spell and Woody Jenkins against, too, at the same time that you had Louisiana Budget Authority, far left group against two as well. So, you know, this was across the spectrum, just thinking some of these things are bad ideas.
So for those that don't like Governor Landry, they think this was a slap in the face, that he expended a lot of political capital. For those that don't, that do like him, they say that's not the case at all. What is it, the truth politically, when it comes to political capital and who won, who lost here, and what happens going into the session?
Well, I would be reluctant to state this is the truth politically, but from my point of view, Landry lost some capital on this one. I mean, he's been riding high. He's had some special sessions. He's had very successful legislative sessions. He's, got a supermajority in both House and Senate. So he's doing really well, but you can't construe this any other way than kind of a slap in the face and a caution to him not to get ahead of the voters.
And what about the other legislators? I know I saw my friend Pat Connick say that they had to, I know he was a strong proponent of this, Amendment number 2, and said that they had to change the way that we do business in the state. He said on the news yesterday, I think talking to a reporter at Channel 4, that they would have to do something. What happens now in the legislature as far as either revisiting this or changing it some type of way?
Oh, I definitely think we're in a, fiscal, so we're in an odd year, so we have a fiscal session. So I think the defeat of 2 is going to mean that this is front and center for the legislature. They're going to try to take a number of other swings at this apple. I imagine they'll do what they can with legislation, and then maybe they'll find a way to spin off a few of these discrete parts that they think are particularly important, like the income tax part, for example, or the education trust fund part, into separate constitutional amendments that voters can digest a bit more easily.
But it all has to be done by amendment and put before the voters. It can't be done just with a legislative action, right?
Much of it. You know, the key here is if it's already in the Constitution, the only way you can change it is by making constitutional amendment. If it's not in the Constitution, then legislation works just fine.
As far as, and we got to go here, I'm a second late, and they get mad at me when I ask a question, but if you can give me a 20-second answer, was there a lot of left opposition to this? Because I didn't hear that much. I don't know. Was this about the campaigning? Would that have made a difference with Governor Landry getting ahead of it or behind it?
No, I think there was some left opposition, based on some of the questions about what it would do to education and changes to the income tax structure. But I didn't hear that much. But there was broad opposition to it, more than just from left or right.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Pearson Cross, ULM. We'll take a break, come back, talk to Keith Spear about Jazz Fest. Right now, time for WWL First News. 8:46, 14 till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL, Tim Zimmer, Manning Master Control, tells me, so I'm attributing this to him, that they've also changed the rule where teams can wear alternative uniforms four times a year, four times a season, Is that at home, on the road, or I guess it, anywhere? It depends on what the other team is wearing, though, because of the colors, etc. Keith Spira joins us now, and as the NFL owners meet, we'll continue to keep you updated as far as any changes that that they approve. Keith Spira, reporter for the Times-Picayune, New Orleans Advocate. How you?
I'm good, Tommy. Good to hear from you.
Good to hear from you, sir. Let's talk about the Jazz Fest cubes that came out. I don't know, with everything going on last week, a lot of it got lost, I guess, maybe with weather or whatever it was. But tell me your thoughts on the cubes and the days you're looking forward to most.
Well, yeah, you know, you don't really get a true picture of the festival's personality until you look at the cubes. You know, the raw list of names that comes out in January only tells you so much. You've really got to look and see who's following who on which stage to really get a sense of the festival. And yeah, look, it's a really interesting year. You know, I mean, you've got one day where the main festival stage, you know, is essentially programmed like the Congo Square stage. You got Lil Wayne and the Roots headlining it. You got Big Frieda on that stage, Tank and the Bangas. So that's really interesting. You know, they've rarely showcased hip hop on the main stage. So to see, you know, the hometown rapper Lil Wayne headline that day will be interesting on the first Saturday. Excuse me. They've got 2 days instead of one where you've got a major country headliner on the main stage. That's both of the Fridays with Casey Musgraves and Luke Combs. So I don't recall a year when you had two country headliners on the main stage like that before. You know, and in fact, that first Saturday, It's a great dichotomy where you've got Lil Wayne headlining the festival stage and Harry Connick Jr. headlining the Gentilly stage at the same time. So two very different New Orleans musicians at opposite ends of the fairground headlining on that day.
So it does kind of go to the diverse nature of New Orleans music, but also I think it goes to not just the diversity of the Jazz Fest, but how music is changing and how the fest is kind of evolving with it. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, I think so. You know,
not that Lil Wayne is a new artist or anything, but you understand what I'm saying.
Well, right. I mean, but, you know, it's just kind of funny. They've never actually had Lil Wayne out there. And I'm sure that was partly on his end. I mean, his scheduling and you know, he doesn't live here anymore. He's based in Miami these days. So, but yeah, they finally got him. You know, I mean, he's been a major figure in hip hop for 20 years now, and they finally got him in a headlining spot. Yeah. And I think they've tried to mix up the presentation a little bit more. You know, in 2024, they had Anderson .Paak and the Free Nationals, which is a band that certainly has a lot of hip hop content to it. They headlined on the festival stage. So they've been moving in this direction a little bit. And this is just the latest iteration of that evolution, I'd say.
Newell Norman just texted me, Lil Weezy, not Lil Wayne. All right, Wayne. Newell, thank you for that. Thank you for that correction. I appreciate
Newell
it.
Newell knows what's up. He does.
Newell texting me, fixing that. Let me take a break, Keith. We'll pick it up when we come back. I want to talk about some of the acts for different genres, different people that are looking for different things, be it classic rock, be it traditional, maybe jazz or New Orleans music, oldies, anything. We'll talk about that more when we come back. 8:50, 10 till 9, talking Jazz Fest Cubes with Keith Spira. He'll be here before you know it. We're into April, April 1st today, and the first day of Jazz Fest, Thursday, April 24th. Traffic now, WWL. 8:56, 4 till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly back to our friend Keith Spira, who is the reporter for Times-Picayune, New Orleans Advocate, about Jazz Fest and the cubes that have come out. What about some classic rock acts, some traditional Jazz Fest artists, etc., Keith?
Well, sure. They had a lot of success last year by booking Heart on the Gentilly stage. So this year you've got two similar kind of, you know, late 70s, early 80s FM radio rock bands. You've got Cheap Trick out there, and you've got Joan Jett and the Blackhearts. So they're kind of scratching that same classic rock itch by having those guys out there again. You know, look, as far as jazz, contemporary jazz, they've got a lot of the big names in contemporary jazz headlining at the Jazz Tent. You've got Joshua Redman. You've got Branford Marsalis, who moved back to New Orleans last year and is going to be playing out there with his quartet. You've got Yellow Jackets. You've got Stanley Clark, the great guitar player. You've got Diana Krall, the piano player and singer. So it's a really strong contemporary jazz lineup out there this year.
Can you break it down by day? And is there one day that would lend itself more to one aficionado of one type of music?
You know, it's so mixed up. I mean, as we said earlier, if you're a country fan, you want to go on either of the two Fridays. You know, if you want to take advantage of, you know, one of the best deals in popular music, buy yourself a $50 ticket on either of the Thursdays, because mm-hmm. there's a little bit of everything on each of those Thursdays. You know, every day is pretty consistent across the genres, I would say. You know, it just depends on which of the big bands you're a fan of. If you're a Dave Matthews Band fan, you go on the first Sunday. You know, if you're a Pearl Jam fan, you go on the second Saturday. But, you know, the crazy thing about the Cubes, too, is you see all the tough choices that you have to make. And it's just, you know, it's just crazy, some of the options that you have. On the last Sunday, the final slot, Trombone Shorty, New Orleans Avenue, My Morning Jacket, Patti LaBelle, Kamasi Washington, Christone, Kingfish, Ingram, Kermit Ruffin's tribute to Louis Armstrong, Marty Stewart, all at the same time. So that's, you know, that's a hard choice to make right there.
You know, when you talk about choices, it got me to thinking, Keith, about, is it science? Is it art? Is there any kind of focus group, any kind of research, any kind of numbers, any kind of math, science, et cetera, when it comes to evaluating one year's festival as it relates to booking the next year's festival, or how far in advance do some of these bookings take place? Do you know?
Well, they're booking some of these folks a year out at least. Mm-hmm. You know, some of the bigger acts plan, you know, tours 1-2 years in advance. So, yeah, some of them were penciled in probably by the time last year's festival was taking place. You know, I think at this point there is sort of a formula. They know they need, you know, X many arena-level rock bands. They know they need X many, you know, major contemporary R&B bands. They know they need, you know, X many jazz acts to fill the jazz tent. And they know that they're going to need, you know, 400-plus Louisiana artists to fill out the rest of the schedule and give this festival its unique personality. So yeah, at this point, I mean, they know how many slots they have to fill. They know about what they want to spend. They know, you know, roughly what ticket sales are going to generate, and all those numbers have to line up.
Thank you. Appreciate your time, Keith. We'll talk to Jeff Nowak when we come back. 9:09 now. Wait, Jordan Fiegel's telling me something in my ear. What is it? The NFL owners have now approved changes to the league's instant replay. I'm repeating it as he tells me. They're going to make it retroactive to go back to the 2018 season and include missed pass interference calls. And that means that the Saints and the Rams will replay the 2018 NFC Championship game that was held in January of 2019. But in order to make it fair, they're going to have to use the same players. So Drew Brees is going to have to come out of retirement, and both rosters will have to be exactly the same. Jordan, is that what you're telling me? That sounds like that movie The Best of Times with Kurt Russell and Robin Williams, where they go back and replay that high school game. Well, that's indeed interesting. Oh, wait a minute. It's April Fool's Day. Jeff Nowak joins us now, WWL Saints sideline reporter. How you doing, Jeff?
You had me in the first half.
Did I?
In the first
did
half.
I really?
Yeah. No,
no kidding.
No. Well, I mean, part of it's true. They have expanded replay a little bit.
Let's talk about what's happened so far since we did start with that. First of all, how you doing, all right?
I'm doing good. How about you?
Good. A pleasure to talk to you as always. Tell me about what the NFL owners have approved so far, what changes we're going to see in next season.
Yeah, so basically the owners' meetings are going on right now, and they always vote on all these proposed rule changes. So there's usually a dozen or so teams submit, hey, I want this rule changed. And, you know, if it gets through that final process, then they vote on them. You know, the Saints actually don't have any submitted this year. There's always certain teams that tend to be in on this. The Lions, for whatever reason, always have a bunch. But, yeah, so far, the only rule changes that have gone through, as far as I understand, are the rules are changing now to basically turn the playoff overtime rules into regular season overtime rules, in that both teams will be allowed to possess the ball. If there's been a lot of changes over the years. You know, if you go back to the Super Bowl, the same Super Bowl, it was, if you kick a field goal on your opening possession, game's over. Mm-hmm. They changed that a few years later so that if you kick a field goal, the other team got a chance to score a touchdown. But if you score a touchdown, the game's over. Now, even if you score a touchdown, the other team still gets a ball and the chance to at least rebut that. And then it would become the first team that scores, which, you know, I think if you're a team that's ever been on the side of, well, we go into overtime and the offense never gets to touch the ball, I think you would support that rule change.
But wait, let me jump in for a second, because I was confused about there being a difference between playoffs and regular season overtime, the difference being that there can be a tie in regular season, but not that was the difference, or what did they change?
There were a few differences. One being, yeah, that if it ended, if the first overtime period ended, then it would go as a tie, which I think you just don't want to get into a situation where you're playing a second football game because neither offense can score, and then you get into a situation with injuries. But you obviously can't have a tie in the playoffs. So in the playoffs, it would just go on until somebody wins. So that's still going to be the case. You can still have a game end in a tie. They did try to get it to be 15 minutes instead of 10, but that got kind of pushed back and amended down to 10 so that they could get it to pass. So the real change is both teams get a chance to get the ball. The other thing that's been changed is they've expanded the replay assist, which we've seen used in situations. I need to kind of look in to see all of the definitions of this rule and what's allowed to be looked at and what's not. But over the last few years, you've seen, a ball's been called complete. And then on the replay, you can clearly see that it hit the ground rather than forcing the other team to throw a challenge flag and have a 5-minute review. There's replay assist has overturned that to an incompletion. But we've seen that. Mm-hmm. They've now added the ability to pick up flags in that system. So if there's a pass interference that is very clear that, hey, that guy didn't touch him, he tripped over his own feet, he went down, they could pick up that flag. They can't add a flag. So that's the difference. Now, Saints fans will be like, wow, what if this existed in 2019 like you were talking about? Mm-hmm. It actually wouldn't have changed anything because you cannot go back and add a flag where there was not a flag. But kind of like the NBA's rule, like you can't review something and add a foul. You can't go back on the NFL and say, well, it was clearly pass interference, but it wasn't called, so you can add it. That's not how it works.
Somebody texted in about electronic tracking for ball placement. Have there been any suggestions at all that they're looking at to try to make the game? See, because one thing I would like to see changed is it's obviously a missed call or a bad call, and the other team hurries up and snaps the ball. That, to me, is just blatant cheating because it's like, okay, well, we know it wasn't a catch, so we're going to go ahead and hurry up and snap the ball before the right thing can happen. And that, to me, sets a bad example for everybody. Thoughts?
I mean, that's just kind of, that's the rule, right? But at the same time, like a lot of times, like, hey, we're not sure if that was a catch. It's not like, oh, it's definitely not a catch. You just don't want to run the risk. So you run a quick play.
Jeffrey? You know, I think that's the idea. Jeffrey, what's your middle name?
Douglas. Actually.
Jeffrey Douglas, come along now. Come on now. Let's be honest. Don't tell me. Don't feed that stuff to me, mister. Your father may buy it, but I'm not going to buy it. I'm not going to believe that they don't know that they're just rushing, right? Because just in case. Come on, man.
Well, they know they don't want it to get looked at. That doesn't mean that it was definitely. Like,
it's
sometimes
cheating.
It like, oh,
it's
it was a
blatant
catch anyway.
Cheating, and they know it is.
Well, but here's the thing. That's what the replay assist is supposed to help with, right? Mm-hmm. Because a lot of times teams won't have the amount of time necessary to get a good replay, especially if you're on the road. Like, this is something I figured out standing on the sideline of games. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll watch it on TV, and they're showing you the replay on TV 10 times by the time that the coach is throwing the flag. But when you're standing on the sidelines, especially on the road, they're not showing you those replays. Like, stadiums understand that the coach on the sideline would very much like to see that replay with his own eyes before throwing that challenge flag. So they're not showing it. At least not until, you know, maybe after it's too late. So that's where the replay assist comes in of, like, the coach has to hear from upstairs watching it on TV, like, oh, they just showed it. Okay, we got it. But a lot of times it doesn't have enough time to happen. So the replay assist kind of takes away that gamesmanship, which I think would be the word I would use as opposed to cheating. Would be gamesmanship.
Kind of
takes
right.
away that
sure.
opportunity. If it's obvious.
But now I'm all for, look, I play golf, I'm all for the rules. Sometimes the rules help you. Sometimes it takes a tree out of play if you're on a cart path. Sometimes it puts a tree in play. I'm all for that. But this just seems like, you know, you're trying to hurry up and get this off before they notice you did something wrong. But along those lines, I always thought, too, since we're having a conversation here, that it was crazy that you only get so many challenges as a coach, even if you're right. It seems to me, as long as you're correcting the officials, if the goal is to get it right, I don't see how you, maybe after one or two wrong challenges, you lose them, but you should be able to keep going forever if you're right in challenging the officials. Am I wrong or not?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of like, I think there's an officials lobby that comes into play at some point being like, can we not? Because if we're screwing up constantly, we don't want it to be pointed out.
But I mean,
constantly.
It's like,
I agree with you.
You're correcting me four. I screwed up four times. Calls. Right. I screwed up four times. You've called me out four times, but you can't do it anymore. Well, if anything, that would be the reason I should be able to do it more, because you're screwing this thing up.
Exactly. Like, if the calls were wrong, then why do I lose the ability to point it out again? I agree with that 100%. I think the same thing's true in the NBA, but to an extent, like, I understand in the NBA because there's kind of this, if you've ever played basketball, there's kind of this understanding. It's like, well, we're not going to call the foul because you clearly fouled him and it went off like the tip of his fingers. So, okay, well, we're just going to give them the ball and we're not going to deal with the foul. But then you challenge and then suddenly it's like, well, we can't call the foul, but it's definitely out of bounds on them. That doesn't really exist in football. Either you did it or you didn't.
I don't know how in the NBA, and now we're really getting off, but I don't know how they call a foul in the NBA. Do you? Because they have their hands all over each other constantly. I don't understand.
It's tough.
I don't get
any sport, but yeah.
So what's likely to pass? I know Tim told me that they get to wear alternative uniforms 4 years. Tim's the fashion police. He keeps me updated on that. But is there anything substantial likely to change? Tush-push, are they going to do away with that or not?
Yeah, I mean, that's the big one on the docket right now. Every year one team or another tries to ban the tush-push. I think it's going to get banned eventually. I don't know if it's going to be this year. The issue they're going to run into is, in most cases, at least for the NFL, they try to hedge on the idea of like, okay, we're going to change rules when it's a safety issue. So players are getting hurt during this play, so we're going to change the kickoff, for example. Like, players were getting hurt, so they tried to find a way to keep the kickoff in the game while tamping down on the injuries. And that's what Darren Rizzi's dynamic kickoff thing, it actually did that, so they're going to keep it. Now, the tush-push, it really doesn't – like, injuries are really not a part of it. You don't really see guys getting injured. I think the argument that coaches would make is, like, the longer this goes on, the more kind of aggressive strategies defenses are going to take, and that you might see situations like we saw in the playoffs where guys start diving over the line, guys are doing whatever they can. I think at the end of the day, it's going to end up getting banned because it has the cardinal sin of being boring. It is a boring football play, and it is not a play that the NFL wants games to come down to, right? The NFL doesn't want a rugby match breaking out in the middle of an NFL football game.
Right.
And the thing is, like, yeah, the Eagles are just way better at it than everybody else. But we've seen over the last few years other teams start to get better at it. And when you have the quarterback and the center who can do it, it's just common sense. Hey, anytime I'm in a short yardage scenario, I'm going to do this. And it's going to, and over time, it's going to become, hey, there's eight teams in the league that do this constantly. And then it's going to be half the league. And then suddenly, if you're not running this play, then you are wasting an opportunity. So does the NFL want a game to turn into that? Does the NFL want every short yardage scenario to be this, like, 6 inches in a cloud of dust thing that's basically impossible to stop? No. So, you know, it's going to happen, and people are going to be like, well, that doesn't make any sense. But rule changes to maintain the entertainment value of a game have existed as long as the games have existed. You see, you know, in baseball, why do you think they have a pitch clock now? Mm-hmm. That's not a safety issue. That's an entertainment value issue. They banned shifts because it was kind of boring to watch these great hitters hit screaming line drives into the side of the infield with five fielders. That's not fun to watch, right? I want to see base hits. I want to see action. In the NBA, they banned transition take fouls because, hey, I want to see dunks. I want to see breakaway dunks. That's exciting. In the NFL, why do you think defensive holding exists, right? Why do you think they've added all of these rules to make it impossible to cover receivers? Because it's more fun to watch a receiver catch the ball and run down the field than it is to watch, you know, 10 incomplete passes in a row. So I think at the end of the day, we're going to come down to this point that they're going to hedge it on injuries, but it's going to come down to, hey, I just want to watch a football game where it does not come down to this every drive.
You, my friend, yeah. We got to go. You are very talented, and I love talking to you, but I do remember during the Kansas, I think it was one Kansas City game, Travis Kelce running about as fast and as hard as he could into the back of Patrick Mahomes trying to get him into the end zone, and I'm watching this thinking, eventually this is going to lead to somebody getting hurt, don't you think?
It'll only take one high-profile quarterback getting hurt in that scenario for it to, you know, become a injury issue. But the numbers will never support it. Like, when you look at the percentage of players injured on an average NFL play versus the percentage of players injured on this specific NFL play, it's never going to be, well, hey, okay, this is a problem play like the kickoff was. But, no, I mean, yeah, Josh Allen and the Bills have been running it a lot. If suddenly Josh Allen, you know, shatters his ankle because someone steps on it, and or he gets pushed and, like, he hyperextends his neck because he's in a bad situation and someone's pushing him from behind, then it'll become a problem. It's just a question of whether the NFL lets it get to that point or just kind of nips it in the bud, which I would prefer they did, because it's not a fun play to watch. Like, I don't want to watch it. Mm-hmm. I get it. They're good at it. It's within the rules. But, again, the rules exist until the rules don't exist. Like, all you have to do is say, hey, you're not allowed to push players from behind in these situations. That's all you have to do. Then suddenly it's a sneak
again. When you're at home watching it, are you going, no, Ariana, that's how I watch it, because and you're right, it's like a scrum. That was a point well made. It is like a scrum in rugby. That's what you're looking at, basically, right?
Right. It would be like saying, hey, the most exciting play is like these backward lateral plays. Like, no, that's rugby. If you want to watch these backward lateral schoolyard plays, go watch a rugby game. That's what it is. I don't know. I think that at the end of the day, the NFL game is more fun when you're playing NFL football and not, you know, this weird kind of, hey, we're really good at this, so we're going to do it. Like, I had someone say, hey, it's a play that only happens 2 to 3 times a game. It's like, no, you're confusing that with a sneak. I have watched the Eagles run this play 2 to 3 times on individual drives. The playoffs against Washington, they actually stopped it once. And then their response was, we're going to do hard counts because the only way you can stop this is to jump the snap. So we're going to do hard counts. And then they end up getting 5 off. Offsides penalties in a row, to the point that the ref's like, hey, if you do that again, we're just going to give them a touchdown. Like, that's a playoff game. That's not what you want a playoff game to come down to. And it's just become ridiculous.
What do you think about being able to pick up a quarterback and use him like a battering ram like they used to do in the Flintstones? Kind of like that. What do you think, huh?
Yeah, like in Lord of the Rings where they had like the big thing where they knocked it against the door a bunch of times until it breaks.
Yeah, battering ram.
Be honest with you.
They call it the old battering ram. The Rams. Sean McVay should create that play and call it the battering ram. We're on to something, Jeff. Tell me about the
pot. On the roster where that's his only job is to come in and get knocked against the line.
Hardhead McMahon, that's what you can call him. Look, if you liked listening to Jeff just now, as I do, tell him about the podcast, Jeff, with you and Steve.
Yeah, Inside Black and Gold. We're going to record an episode probably later today talking about Kellen Moore, what he had to say at the owners' meetings. He talked for about a half hour. We haven't really gotten into it, but didn't really say a ton. But we'll get into what he had to say. Talked about they're going to have training camp in Metairie this year. Yay, sweating. I do still think they're going to go out to have joint practices somewhere. Hey, maybe in Irvine again. Who knows? But, yeah, we're going to get into a lot of that. We're going to talk about just general stuff from the offseason, you know, mock drafts, all that good stuff. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find it on YouTube at WWL Sports. A lot of good stuff on there, so hey, check it out.
I didn't bring it up because I didn't want to steal your podcast thunder. Thank you, Jeff. Pleasure as always. Jeffrey Douglas Nowak. Jordan tweeted me, Jeff, no fun league, Nowak, apparently because he's a Jalen Hurts fan. He loves the tush push. Thank you, Jeff. 9:25, we come back. We'll talk about Americans being unhappy as it relates or unhappier than the rest of the world. We'll talk about some keys to happiness when we return on WWL. It is 9:31, a little bit late. We're concerned about mental health here. We every Tuesday talk to Dr. Judy Ho, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. Morning, Dr. Judy. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine. How's Luca?
He is good. We just got back from a little vacation. So, yeah, he's just recovering.
Awesome. You know what I've been doing? I got a new dog. What I've been doing is loading a Nerf gun with a ball and shooting it across the yard, which is about 30 yards wide. And when he comes back, I give him a little treat, and it wears him out pretty quickly. I don't know if you want to try that with Luca. I'm just kidding. It's a joke. I'm just playing. Happy April's Fool's Day to you. Do you suggest people make April Fool's jokes or not as a licensed clinical neuropsychologist?
I mean, I always think that they're fun, but, you know, some people can't take a joke, right? So I guess you have to know your audience.
Yeah, you know that because you own your own practice. If you work for somebody and you find yourself in human resources, you suddenly realize as you're sitting there at the conference table and you thought that was funny and you say, at the time, yeah, I guess I did, but certainly not now. Am I fired? Let's talk about World Happiness Country Rankings. The United States not doing so well behind Finland, Denmark, Iceland, Sweden, Netherlands, Costa Rica, Norway, Israel, Luxembourg, Mexico, Australia, New Zealand, Switzerland, Belgium, Ireland, Lithuania, Austria, Canada, Slovenia, Czechia? Is that a Russian country or is that, I don't know, UAE, what? It's a Russian country. I didn't know if that was a shorthand for Czechoslovakia. The countries, Dr. Judy, who can keep track of them? UAE, Germany, and the U.S. and the U.K. Why is the U.S. so unhappy?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. I actually recall the World Happiness Rankings, and we actually talk about it in a couple of my classes that I teach at Pepperdine. And there's usually six key predictors of national happiness. One is GDP per capita. So I think if we were going by that, you'd think that America would be very high up top. But the other one that's really important is social support. Do people really feel like they have someone to count on in times of need? And in general, if you're from a country where family structures are a bit close-knit, you're in much closer connection with your neighbors, the people in your community, you're going to score much higher on that. And I think that America overall tends to score a bit lower on that than other countries, especially because we're an individualistic country. Most of the times, one of the values that people hold is that we should be independent. And so it's just not like how it is in certain more collectivistic countries where it's just the norm that you see lots of people every day and that you connect with people, that sometimes you put your needs behind the group's needs because that's really what helps everybody to feel better. We're just not really used to thinking that way. So I think that social support is a big part of it. A couple of the other key predictors of national happiness, healthy life expectancy, freedom to make life choices, generosity, and then perception of corruption. So that's interesting, right? So a lot of countries are very corrupt.
You're talking about the government of the countries or the institutions?
Yeah, I think that it's more about trust or distrust in society and government. But it's the perception, and that I think is the key. So obviously there's corruption everywhere. It's just the fact of life, right? But it's really your perception of how corrupt your country's government or society is. And as you know, Tommy, our country is in a lot of turmoil right now emotionally about the government. Everybody has such strong opinions. There's a lot of distrust. There's even some paranoia. I mean, sometimes there is something unseemly going on. Other times there may not be, but you still think that there are, and you're getting really worked up about it. So I think that that could also play a role. And then I think it's just this idea of work-life balance, right? So even this idea of freedom to make life choices, this is one of the most important, like one of the six key predictors of national happiness. We have a lot of freedom in America, but a lot of people feel like, again, this is because of the cultural value and cultural norm, that they have to just be grinding really hard at work. There isn't the kind of work-life balance that there often is with some of the countries that are near the top of the National Happiness Survey. And so I think that, you know, those are, in my opinion, the main reasons why America is so much lower than we might expect.
One thing that does make me unhappy is when I'm fed wrong information. By Tim Zimmer in Master Control, Chechia is the name of the Czech Republic. Chechnya is in Russia. Thank you, Tim. I'm able to sound stupid on my own. I don't need your help, okay? I'm just kidding. Thank you. It sounds like Chechnya. I'm not ragging on you, Tim. I just wanted to clear that up for the audience. Dr. Judy, let's talk about the role of social support here. And somebody texted me 2 hours ago. And said they feel as though, because I knew you were coming on, we were talking about it, they feel as though, and it was a long test, I'll try to paraphrase it. Basically, have you seen these movies where the dive ships go and they leave the person alone and the dive ship is gone and they're all by themselves? They say that's how they feel in their life. You never seen those movies?
Okay. Cool.
You never seen them? Yeah, they're diving, and then everybody loads up on a dive ship, and they miscount how many people the boat, and they go about, and a person's just left there adrift in the water, and nobody comes and gets them. Yeah, it is a nightmare. And they said that's how they feel socially. I've seen a couple of those movies. That's why I knew what they were talking about. And they said that's how they feel, that they're out there treading water for as long as they can, and that nobody's coming. They have a family member that's occasionally like a plane that flies overhead to make sure they're still there, and they don't know what to do. So that certainly, yeah, exactly. That was my response. And when I saw that and thought about world happiness rankings, I thought, well, this person is certainly among the unhappy in the United States. So what would you even tell them to start? What? How? I don't know. I mean, you need more details, but generally speaking.
Yeah. You know, I think that in general, when people are feeling a bit, I mean, seriously adrift, this is a very good metaphor that this person just gave. It's important to remember that you don't need 1,000 friends. You don't need 100 friends. You don't even need 10 friends. You just need, you know, 1, 2, or 3 really quality people that you can have a deeper connection with. That's what we're talking about in terms of social support. We're not talking about you are best friends with all of the neighbors on your street. We're talking about people who actually really mean something, who you can really count on. And you may say, well, I just have literally no one like that in my life. And I think the goal is to really just start small and just try to cultivate one meaningful relationship at a time. So the easiest way is to start with the people who are already in your social circle and think about, well, is there somebody here that maybe if I put a little bit more effort in, especially if they were also, you know, going to respond in kind like that, that would result in a more meaningful connection with this person. And then just reach out to them and, you know, call them, ask them out for a coffee or a lunch, like start spending more time with them, you know, but it does take you having to extend the olive branch a little bit because nobody can read your mind. Nobody knows that you want to have a deeper connection with them unless you do something about it. If you really feel like no one in your life fits that type of bill, then, you know, challenging yourself to join something in the community, join something like a volunteer activity, and try to meet some people who you might be able to establish a connection with that way. But
Doctor, I scrolled down.
Thing is to start with one person.
I scrolled down like 18 pages because I wanted to get this right for this person. And the text said, I feel as though my family left me behind, much like a diver whose boat leaves without him. And I don't know how much longer I can tread water. That was the exact text. So I don't know if that changes anything that I said earlier or not, but. So you're saying basically try to find somebody?
Yeah, just find one person to start. And it might not be the people that you thought it was going to be, right? So I think this person is saying their family is not there for them. And, you know, a lot of people end up creating their own families, right? It might not be your family of origin. It might be other people that can try to fill that role. And I think sometimes the pain comes from, and of course you have to grieve that, you know, comes from, well, but my family should be the people who are the ones there for me. It doesn't mean it won't change at some point down the line. You know, things are not static. Sometimes people will say, well, it'll never change with my mom, et cetera. It's like, well, it's possible, but it's also possible she might, you know? So it's not necessarily that it's going to go on forever, that you have a strained relationship with your family members. But at least as it is right now, it's helpful to try to let go of that expectation that your closest inner circle should be certain people, you know, because that also adds to the perception of loneliness and sadness and not feeling connected.
Somebody texted in, tell that person go to a good non-denominational church. They'll be welcome and have more friends than they know what to do with quickly. So I guess that's an idea. Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Volunteer,
exactly.
I would think, that with an organization. Maybe volunteer with somebody, get to know somebody there. Doctor, do you do deep sea diving?
I don't. I don't.
Because I can tell you the movies open water, and they have like three of them, open water 1, 2, or 3, if you ever want to watch those. We'll take a break, come back. We're talking to Dr. Judy about ways to be happy. If you have any questions or comments, 504-260-1870. And I will ask you, you don't have to tell me your name or anything, but generally speaking, scale of 1 to 10, where are you when it comes to happiness? And I'll ask Dr. Judy when we come back, what is a reasonable expectation as we all matriculate through life as to a good number to be on the happiness scale? I think if you're hitting six, you're doing pretty good, considering everything, but we'll see. 942, 18 till 10, more when we return. Tommy Tucker, WWL. 9:47, 13 till 10, couple of minutes left with Dr. Judy Ho, licensed clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast, instructor at Cal Pepperdine. I get that right?
At Pepperdine? Yeah, I'm a tenured professor there.
Tenured professor at, what is it? Cal Pepperdine.
Pepperdine University.
Pepperdine University. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, Dr. Judy, for my ignorance.
No problem.
Let's talk about, somebody texted in and said, happiness is all about expectations. I cannot allow myself to expect anything from anybody, and that way I can't get disappointed. Thoughts?
Well, I mean, definitely, I think that that's a tactic, but also don't not allow yourself to have some expectations. Sometimes that's okay. But I understand that. I do understand that as a coping strategy and as a personality trait where it's like, okay, well, if I just don't put a ton of expectations on someone, then I'm not going to be upset if they don't do what I want to have them do. But I do think that it's okay to have some expectations, especially if you communicate them to that person, right? I mean, I think that what's hard is if you expect them to do something and they have no idea what your standards are, and then all of a sudden you're upset and they're like, wait, why was that something I was supposed to do to make you happy? But if it's somebody that you trust and love and you want to say, hey, you know what makes me feel really special? If you do X, like, or you know what makes me happy? If you do this from time to time. If you tell that to them and then they don't do it, then at least you have a starting place to talk about it and to negotiate. But I think it's okay to have some expectations if you communicate them ahead of time.
See, and I'm going to play devil's advocate here and ask you, what would be the downside of not having any expectations? Because just from the logic, not emotional standpoint, it would seem, well, you can't be disappointed if you don't have any expectations. But if somebody does do something nice for you, then it will be even more enjoyable because you didn't expect it. Where's my thinking wrong?
Well, I would counter that. It's very natural for human beings, just the way our minds are built, to have expectations is actually what helps us to navigate the world. You know, like, what do I expect in this situation versus this other situation? And I think that when you say you don't have any expectations, it's really coming out of a place of trying to protect yourself. So even though maybe deep down you do have some expectations, you're saying that you don't. And so I think that it's just impossible for human beings to not have any expectations. Like, it's okay to have few. I think that makes sense. But I think just the way that our brains are, it's hard not to, because we're built that way. It's evolutionarily driven. You know, we have to be able to know what to expect so that we can navigate the world better and survive better. So I would just ask this person, are you being 100% honest that you have zero expectations of anyone in your life? Like, would you have an expectation that if you were in a life-threatening situation, that if you called somebody, they'd be there for you? Like, or do you really have not even that expectation of somebody that you care about?
I guess,
right?
What they meant more, and maybe I'm wrong here, I interpreted it more as, you know, on a personal relationship, as opposed to, obviously, you expect the police to come if you call them. You expect the people at work to do their job, even if they tell you the country's wrong. You expect those kind of things. But when it comes to personal, expecting somebody to do this for you or do that for you, not in a work or public service kind of thing. That's how I interpreted it, but maybe I'm wrong.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, obviously we can't ask this listener exactly what they mean, but right. I would say that in general, you know, people who don't say they don't have any expectations means that they don't actually feel like they can have someone they can lean on in hard times. So I just want to make sure that if that's the angle, then, you know, opening yourself up to saying, yeah, I do have some expectations of how I should be treated by the people that I love. And that is part of that perception of social support. That is a happiness factor index. So, you know, I think that it's okay. It's okay to have expectations, but making sure that they're reasonable and they're communicated properly. I just think that it's too hard to expect yourself to not have expectations of anyone. I just don't know how easy that would be, really, for every single aspect of your life, especially with the people that you cherish the most and are the closest to you.
Suppose, I lost my train of thought here, because somebody told me to Google Pepperdine University, and I did. They pay you to go there?
They pay you? I mean,
you. I'm saying they pay
salary.
You to go to work there?
Yes.
It's so beautiful, you should pay them. That's the only point I'm making. Real quick, before we leave, what is reasonable to expect in happiness in your life? Because it is about, you know, maybe, what do they say in sales, where you over-deliver and under-promise, over-deliver? What is reasonable to expect on a scale of 1 to 10 in everyday life to be happy? You're not going to be 10 all the time. That's not real.
No. No, exactly. No, you're not going to be a 10 every day. And it's okay not to be. I mean, that's the whole point of life. You're going to enjoy the 10s more when they happen only infrequently. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, how would you know the difference? And so, you know, I think that this is part of the problem, whether it's expectations of people that you love, like similar to what your last listener was just talking about in their text, or like expectations of your own happiness level every day. I think that we usually oftentimes overshoot it, you know, and it's really just about, well, am I able to do the things for myself or ask for help when I need to get myself to that slightly higher level of happiness today? It's okay that sometimes it's a 2, because things can happen sometimes, or maybe you struggle with clinical depression and there's going to be those days. But it's really about, am I able to kind of take a look, self-reflect, and say, here's what I can do to boost my mood a bit today, whether it's an activity I can do myself, a coping strategy that I know works, or reaching out to one or two people that I know always make me feel better if I talk to them or spend time with them. Like, it's just about having personal agency to change your happiness from moment to moment. And if you have that locked in, you're going to feel a lot better. And it's not really about the day-to-day, I have to be a 10 or a 9 or an 8, because human life, we're going to be up and down. That's just how it is. And so even just having that level of expectation is super important. And by the way, the happiest countries, they tend to know that a little bit more and kind of understand that concept. They normalize moderate expectations. So that's an interesting fact, right? Nordic cultures, always at the top of this happiness survey, they tend to normalize having a moderate expectation of life. So that's what I was saying about not having no expectations at all, but not having high ones, just having moderate ones. And also they prioritize contentment over constant striving. So it's not always about the hustle and bustle. Sometimes it's about just slowing down and say, I just want to enjoy the day. And that's okay. That doesn't make me a lazy person.
I enjoy the day. I'm happy when I talk to you, Dr. Judy Ho, licensed clinical neuropsychologist, tenured professor at Pepperdine University. Taking a break, coming back, WWL. WWL.